What's up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today's March 5th, 2020. This podcast is brought to you exclusively by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. If you enjoy the content, which will always be free and will never have advertisements in the middle of an interview or in the middle of a rant that I am on, because I hate when people put ads in the middle of their shit, sign up on Patreon and to help support the podcast. For that, you got to pay the cost of dealing with me shouting out my patrons for the first couple minutes of every podcast. I think it's a pretty good deal on my part, because you can always fast forward if you don't like it, but I encourage you to stay, listen, and let me tell you about some badass motherfuckers that support me. First and foremost, my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a investor and day trading service. Great community of people that, if you are a day trader or you are an investor, can bring a lot of value to your trading game. What do they do with the Trader's Path? The Trader's Path was set up by my brother Pete Hedgetis, who was actually a customer of a bunch of different trading services that he came to hate after he figured out that they didn't give a shit about their customers and only cared about cashing their checks like many other trading services out there. So Pete started the Trader's Path to try to do something a little bit different. He offers daily watch lists, he offers a daily live stream, he offers investor education. Basically, it's like having a community to day trade with on a daily basis. Pete is a sharp dude, too. I watch what he puts on Twitter. You can always follow him on Twitter. That link's in the podcast description for free. But he's a sharp dude. He understands the market. He trades red markets like the ones that we're in now. He trades green markets. He trades the volatility, the type of shit that we're in now. He doesn't waste people's time with fraud and low float garbage or any of that crap. So check out my friends over at The Trader's Path. There's a link to their service in my podcast description. They are also offering a businessman special. So if you only trade on the side, you're not a full-time trader, they have a separate program for you where you can pay less and still get the benefits of most of what they do. Check out The Trader's Path. The link is in the podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at the Sang Lucci Steam Room. These guys are the original OGs of tape reading. They are the original OGs of reading options flow. It is a strategy that they have used to be successful over the course of almost a decade now. I know, just like I know Pete Hedgetis, I know Sang Lucci, and I know his partner, Charlie Bathgate, very well. Good people, honest people, and most of all, sharp people that know how to make money. What do? They do a couple of things. They run the Steam Room, which is a live, online, real-time chat room that's going to show you where money is moving in the options market. That's important because that money often precedes moves in the equities market. They also have a master course, which is a lengthy investor education course as taught by Lucci, so you know it's going to be easy to understand. There's going to be no jargon, no bullshit, and no wasting of your time. Also, they're offering a product called the 3LT Playbook. If you want to take that education, you want to condense it and make it simple, three rules that Lucci used to make himself a seven-figure trader, they're going to give you those with no bullshit, nothing else on the side. All those links are in the podcast description. Also, if you are a day trader or an investor, another great tool for you is RumorHound. RumorHound is a service that has been supporting the podcast for almost a year now. I appreciate the shit out of these guys. RumorHound.ai. It is a service that takes potential merger and acquisitions, the rumors that you see on a daily basis, it spits them back out to you after plugging them into the proprietary algorithmic artificial intelligence-based system and making a decision as to whether or not the rumors are something you might want to pay attention to or rumors that you might want to not pay attention to. As you know, money can be made in mergers and acquisitions, especially if you're a day trader. Not only that, but if you can follow them on Twitter, the link's in the podcast description, at RumorHound, and you're going to get real-time alerts, okay? Great account to have on mobile push alerts. You're going to get real-time alerts as to these merger and acquisition rumors as they happen. So get the news as they happen and then get their diagnosis of whether or not they think it's a good idea using their proprietary set of variables. I've used the software. It's beautiful aesthetically. It works well. Check out my friends over at RumorHound. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my friend Jay Mintzmyer, the shipping analyst, Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud, my homeboy, Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, my brother Crichton Titus, my friend Ken, J.K. Cunningham, Stank Love, Brainerd Ferguson. Quick shout out to the anonymous motherfuckers that are shooting me some Bitcoin. I appreciate you guys. my friends that have reached out on PayPal. Thank you guys so much. And some of my newest patrons and guys that have re-upped, like my brother Santo P, Matt Marsh, D's Nuts, Evan Thomas, Jonathan Sader, Matt Welk, my brother Will, Kendall Hawk, Farnoosh Mazaray, Mark Wang, Justin Roberts. Thank you guys so much. And of course, Tyler Sandifer, Stephen Clark, Mike Gallup, Hobfish. I haven't forgotten you guys that have been with me for a while. Jonah Johnson. And you got to have faith. I see you, brother. All right. Two rules for this podcast. First and foremost, I'm not an investment advisor, and this is not investment advice. Do your own research. Do your research elsewhere. Don't attribute anything you do to me, or bad things are going to happen. You're going to wind up broke, penniless, living in the back of a dumpster and swigging on a quart of E&J brandy. With that being said, the other rule to this podcast is I do recommend a 2-drink minimum. If you're in a long-only portfolio, you're probably already hammered, so congratulations on that. And with that being said, let's get the damn show started today. Who better to have on today than my favorite economist and the man himself, the CEO of Euro Pacific Capital, the CEO of Schiff Gold, my good friend Peter Schiff. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. But those aren't exactly my titles.
Well, I just made them actually, up.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually the my title with Euro Pacific Capital is senior is chief economist and market strategist.
Uh-huh.
And I'm the chairman of Schiff Gold.
You're like the you're like Sid Rothstein, yeah, the food and beverage manager of the Tangiers, right? In casino.
Yeah. I used to be CEO of Euro Pacific, but not anymore. And I guess I'm out in Puerto Rico now, and so I don't have time to run a broker dealer. But what I do is I manage money, I manage assets for the clients over there. I do own Euro Pacific Asset Management, which is based here in Puerto Rico. I have a bank here as well. Basically what I'm mainly involved in, though, is the asset management side of the business with separately managed accounts, my proprietary mutual funds, and we do all that. You know, I have a team out here in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, are you looking for a CEO? Because I'm available.
No, I think, you know, well, we could always use more clients. I mean, that's the key, you know. I mean, and, you know, this is the time here. I mean, gold's, it's up another $35 today. But the gold stocks, I was just noticing, you know, that gold is less than 1% from the high that it hit on February 24th.
Right.
Yet the GDX is about 6% off of that high. The GDXJ, which is junior miners, is 14% off that high. And even today, gold is actually up a higher percentage than the GDX or the GDXJ. I mean, so normally you don't get that. Normally when gold is up, the gold stocks are up more. But there's still, you know, I've never seen a less loved bull market in gold than the one we got right now. I mean, the gold traders are so afraid of this rally. They don't believe in it. They think gold's going to fall at any minute now. And so they're really reluctant to buy the stocks. Meanwhile, we just keep on rising.
Well, Fleckenstein told me a couple days ago on the podcast that when he sees gold spot take off and the miners not follow, that means there's a lot of hot money in gold. Do you agree with that?
Well, I know in the past what's happened is, you know, whenever you see the gold stocks not confirming the rise in gold, gold ends up selling off. And so I think when you see that you don't get the buying in stocks, people are worried that it's a harbinger of a sell-off. And so they're reluctant to buy. And maybe they even try to get in front of that trade by selling the miners. But meanwhile, gold just keeps rising. And I think that one drop, that one day last week where it dropped 50, 60 bucks, scared a lot of people. Because last week, gold stocks were down 20% in 1 week. And the price of gold it was basically flat on the week. And now look at the rise we've had this week, and we haven't, you know, we've recovered half of what we lost last week. But yeah, I mean, I was buying more gold stocks myself on Friday. I put more money into my gold fund on Friday. I just thought it was just an incredible opportunity to just increase an allocation that I have, and I'm already way overweight gold stocks, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity. People are just giving these away, and yeah, I don't know what was behind it. I mean, maybe there were a lot of day traders in there. I still think that that's what's going on. I don't think there's any real money yet that has moved into this sector. I still don't think the people that manage, you know, other people's money for a living have figured this out yet. So there's day traders in there, but I don't think you've seen the pension funds or even the hedge funds or the endowments make any kind of strategic allocation shift to mining stocks. Like they haven't decided that, you know, let's have a 1% or a 2% weighting and go up from a 0% weighting to actually understand that stagflation is what's coming and that the coronavirus is a pin. But, you know, the important thing is the bubble that the pin pricks. And, you know, nobody knows what exactly the pin is going to be for any given bubble. But we do know that every bubble eventually finds its pin.
Right.
And what the real question, right, the real problem here is the Fed has erected this extremely leveraged economy where everybody has massive amounts of debt. And the reason that we all have so much debt is because every time we tried to pay down debt and have a recession, the Fed interfered to prevent that from happening by getting us to take on more debt. And so instead of having a healing recession where debts are paid down and balance sheets are improved, we just keep levering up. And the Fed prevents the economy from restructuring. Companies that should go out of business are kept in business. People that should go bankrupt are extended additional credit. And so we just delay the inevitable, and we make everybody, or help everybody go deeper and deeper into debt. And the problems just get exacerbated, not solved. And so now here you are, you've got all this debt, and something happens, and you have, you know, the coronavirus. And so people aren't going to travel as much. They don't want to go out to bars or restaurants or just check into hotels. And so all of a sudden you have a bunch of businesses that have a lot of debt that are not getting their revenue.
Right.
And then you have, you know, production bottlenecks. You have workers not showing up. And so, you know, maybe things aren't being produced. And so the supply of goods is being cut. And all this stuff is happening. And it would be okay if we had a viable economy, had the Fed not interfered and stimulated so many times in the past, we could weather the storm. But we can't because the businesses don't have revenues. They can't pay their debts. They can't service their debts. They lay off their employees. Their employees don't have any savings. The employees are living paycheck to paycheck. How are you going to pay your rent? How are you going to pay your mortgage or your credit card bills or your auto loans when you don't have your paycheck? You know, if people had savings, you know, it'd be fine. I mean, it'd be a problem, but it wouldn't be catastrophic. But the Fed has created this gigantic credit bubble, and the minute it finds a pin, it implodes. And now all they can do is, oh, we're going to slash interest rates, keep cutting, keep cutting, keep cutting, go to zero. We're going to print money. We're going to do more QE. We're going to – they keep saying we need a fiscal stimulus. We need to print more money and send it out directly to consumers. What is that going to do? That's not going to cure the virus. That's not going to put more products on the shelves. Right? That's not going to make people travel who otherwise are staying home because they don't want to catch the virus. All that's going to do is destroy the dollar and make prices go up. All they're doing is creating inflation, and now they're making the stagflation even worse.
Yeah, Peter, are you on speaker or on handset?
Handset.
Yeah, if you could just back off the mic just slightly. It's just all right. Little too loud, but otherwise you sound great. Do you think that people are avoiding gold mining stocks and going right to gold because, you know, they feel like gold miners are a riskier proposition because you have a management team in there and a business also where things can kind of go wrong even though the price of gold is rising?
Well, that's part of it, but I think it's more a reflection of what people think the price of gold is going to be in the future. So I think that the physical buyers of gold, right, are basically safe haven buyers. They're buying gold by and large as a store of value. And when you're in an environment where central banks are printing money and rates are at zero, if you just want to really play it safe, right, if you want to find a place to park your money, I mean, there are people who think parking your money in a 10-year treasury at 0.9 is safe. I mean, I think that's lunacy. I mean, there's nothing safe about that, right? But if you want to do something safe, if you want to be out of stocks and out of bonds and out of cash, what do you buy? Well, you buy gold. You buy real value, real money. So, and I think central banks are in there buying gold. I mean, they're buying gold as a reserve asset because I think they're preparing for the day where the dollar collapses and it's no longer the reserve currency, and central banks have to back their paper by real money, by gold. So you have central bank demand, you have real safe haven buying of physical gold. And remember, every single day now, gold makes another record high in every currency but the dollar. Now, the dollar is going to join that list soon enough, right? Gold is going to be making highs in the dollar. So, but people all around the world just look at the price of gold, and it's constantly going up. And what they're really looking at is the value of their currency constantly going down. And what are they going to do about it? I mean, if they put their currency in the bank, the interest they get is so low that it doesn't right. even come close to offsetting the decline. Right. So you have this constant flow of money into gold. Now, gold stocks, it's a whole different animal here. So with gold stocks, now you're talking about investors, right? You're talking about speculators. And what are they doing? They are looking at what they think the future price of gold is going to be. Not what the price of gold is doing today, because the stock is going to be a discounted value of all the profits that the company is going to make in the future. And I think the speculators, right, the investors, don't believe that the gold rally is sustainable. They think that, well, this is just a short-term thing, that gold's going to go down, that the economy is sound, the economy is great, and they don't see why, and they don't even understand why people are going gold, buying gold. I mean, the average Wall Street portfolio manager has no idea, doesn't understand this at all, doesn't understand paper money or fiat money or inflation or economics, and so in his mind, it doesn't even make sense that the price of gold is going up, other than the fact that people are buying it because they don't know what else to do with their money. And so they don't think that these gold companies are actually going to make money off of a temporary increase in the price of gold.
Right.
And since they assume the price of gold is going to fall, well, they probably think the gold stocks are going to get killed. Right. Oh, yeah. When gold goes down. So they're not buying. They're not making the allocations. And to me, this is just another contrarian indicator of how much higher the price of gold is going to go, because all the speculators, all the investors are betting that it's not going to keep rising. In fact, they're betting that it's not going to stay where it is. If you look at how much money now these major gold companies are making, the big ones, right, the Barricks, the Newmonts, right, these guys are making a ton of money at $1,680 gold, and oil prices are going down. And, you know, and the gold price is rising even faster in terms of Canadian dollars or Australian dollars than right. in U.S. dollars, which is where the mines are. So these guys are making tons of money. They're going to be able to increase their dividends. I mean, their dividend yields are way higher than the yields on treasuries. And so since physical gold doesn't have a yield, but these gold stocks do, but investors are still bullish. They're still optimistic on the stock market. They're optimistic on the U.S. economy. And they still don't even realize that Donald Trump is probably not going to get reelected, right? I mean, they're excited now that maybe Sanders is not going to be the nominee, but nobody ever thought Sanders had a chance except me. I actually thought Sanders could win, but I wasn't sure, right? I knew that he's so radical that he may, in fact, have lost to Trump in a recession. But a run-of-the-mill Democrat like Biden, there's no way Biden's going to lose if we're in a recession on Election Day. Just no way. And if you think we're printing a lot of money now, the budget, you think the budget deficits are big now with a Republican president and a Republican Congress,
right.
Imagine how much larger they're going to be with a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress in a recession that Biden is going to inherit from Trump. I mean, these deficits are going to be $3 trillion, $4 trillion, even without the Green New Deal and Medicare for All. So the amount of money printing, and of course, that's what they're going to do, right? Because they're going to hit the zero bound, right? By the time President Biden takes office, we'll be at zero, you know? So it's all going to be QE. It's all going to be money printing. I mean, we're going to have massive inflation in this country. I mean, if you think that central banks can solve any problems, right? Everybody is looking at the Fed to solve problems, right? Oh, we've got a coronavirus, and because of this virus, we have a shortage of goods that are not being produced, and we have a lot less economic activity because people don't want to travel. What the hell can the Federal Reserve do about that? What does printing money, creating money, how does that solve any of those problems? It doesn't. You know, and maybe what's going to happen is people are finally going to realize that the Federal Reserve never had a magic wand for anything. It's never solved any problems. All it's done is made every problem it tried to solve worse. And the irony of it is the problems it's trying to solve are the ones that it created.
Right.
And it solves them by making them worse. The only thing the Fed has ever succeeded in is kicking the can down the road. That's it. You can give them credit for delaying the day of reckoning. But I don't want to give them credit for that because delaying the day of reckoning makes it worse.
Right.
It means we deal with a bigger problem later rather than dealing with it now when it's not as big. And, you know, it's like the rule of holes, right? What's the first rule of holes? Stop digging, right? Well, the Fed doesn't know that rule. All the Fed knows is dig, 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 right? Well, the bigger you make that hole, the harder it's going to be to get out.
Yeah, and, you know, you made a very good point when you talk about what's going to happen when a Democrat's elected versus what's happening now. I mean, if you think things are bad now, you know, fiscally and monetarily, just wait. And they're talking about Warren joining Sanders now because you saw she dropped out of the race today, right? So you think if
I saw that, you know, but I thought it was interesting that she didn't drop out before Super Tuesday when it might have actually helped Sanders. But I think they kept her in. I think she's almost like a spy or what do you call it, a double agent. Because if she really cared about Sanders, she'd have dropped out before Tuesday like everybody else. Once she saw, you know, Buttigieg and Klobuchar and Beto, right, everybody like endorsing Biden, she should have immediately dropped out and endorsed Sanders if she really wanted Sanders. I think they got her to stay in, you know, just to make it even harder for Sanders to win.
Well,
in some of those things, and really not. And now it's like now that he's totally out, she could drop out. But you never. She's not even like rushing to endorse him, you know.
Yeah,
even now
they supposedly had like positive discussions today or something. They're calling it. But you know, you also made a good point before about avoiding the system in general. I mean, I remember back to when we both spoke at the Benzinga conference last summer. I mean, one of the things that we both harped on was the fact that the Fed was making these cuts while the market was at all-time highs and taking, you know, what little ammunition it had out of its quivers at the time. And, you know, that's a thing that you said and I said would both come back to bite them in the ass now. But again, that's not even the solution, right? Rate cuts really, it's not really the solution to a problem that's a biological problem. It's
no, I mean, but the thing is, that's all they can do. All they can do is try to put more air into the bubble. But the solution is to admit that everything they've done in the past was a mistake. The solution is to raise interest rates, to cut the money supply. That's the solution. But of course, that's a painful solution, and it's much more painful because they delayed it for so long. But because it's now so painful because of all the delay tactics, they just want to keep delaying it until we have hyperinflation, until they destroy the dollar. I mean, we're headed for a massive financial currency crisis. And, you know, you watch the mainstream media. I was watching it today. You watch like a CNBC or something, and every single guest is clueless.
Yeah,
I mean, they had Jeff Gunlock on there but even he is not, you know, out there and telling people what's actually going to happen. I mean, he was there recommending fiscal policies. Oh, we need the government to send checks, just like, you remember, George Bush sent out those stimulus checks.
Yeah,
that didn't stop the financial crisis. Look, the last thing we need is more stimulus. That's the reason we're in this mess, because of the stimulus of the past. The next stimulus is going to be an overdose. That's where we're headed. That's where we've always been headed. They're going to destroy the dollar. I mean, wait till the dollar starts to tank. Wait till the bond market bubble pops, because that's going to happen. Wait till interest rates start to rise. Wait till the Fed loses control of interest rates. And
right.
Dunlop was on there now talking about, well, hey, they're going to start buying corporate bonds. Yeah, they're probably going to start buying corporate bonds, because if they don't, they're going to default. You know, I mean, the rates are going to start to skyrocket for corporations. But that's even more money printing. Right? But the bond bubble has to pop, and I think the dollar bubble is going to pop first. So I think you'll start to see the dollar really weaken. But once the dollar really starts to go down, bonds have to follow, because all bonds are IOU dollars. In fact, they barely have a coupon now. There's not that much difference between a treasury and currency, because the yield's almost the same. But the problem is, you know, the currency, the bond is locked up. You get a 10-year treasury, your dollar is locked up for 10 years. Okay, well, what's that dollar going to buy 10 years from now? We don't even know what it's going to buy 10 minutes from now. So ultimately, if the dollar cracks, the bonds have to crack more. And then what happens? And imagine how bad it's going to be when the Fed no longer has the ability to lower interest rates. When rates are going up, as we're in a recession, and then as prices are going up. See, in the last recession, the Great Recession, consumers were relieved by prices not going up and interest rates coming down. What happens if during the next recession we have a big increase in consumer prices and mortgage rates go up?
Right.
Credit card rates go up. Imagine how bad that's going to be. I mean, if we thought that last recession was a great recession, we hadn't seen nothing yet. Wait till we see how great a recession can be when the cost of living goes up and interest rates go up during the recession.
Yeah, that's an absolutely deadly combination. Just to go back to what you're saying about you think the dollar is going to go first. I mean, the dollar index over the last 2 weeks, something like the last 10 sessions, has gotten absolutely smoked.
It hasn't been smoked. It's barely down. I mean, well, we're down below 97. So
right.
We're down about 3%.
From a little bit over 100, I think, in just like 8 or 9 sessions.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I'm talking about, let's have this thing crash. Let's see the dollar index drop 10, 20%. You know, not 3%.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, that's good for the course of 10 trading sessions, 9 trading sessions is the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, but also the thing is, the dollar is losing value against the Swiss franc, the euro, the yen. But, you know, look at the Canadian dollar's down today. The Aussie dollar's down today. I mean, I want to see when you see the dollar going down against everything, all the fiat currencies, right? Right now it's losing against the safe haven currencies but gaining against some of the commodity currencies. But that's also interesting. The dollar is not a safe haven.
Right.
Right? Because it's going down against the yen. It's going down against the Swiss franc. It's going down against gold. And so if the dollar is not a safe haven, how can treasuries be a safe haven?
Right.
How can anybody be buying a treasury and thinking they're doing something safe? They're not. They're doing something insanely risky. I mean, I actually think that the people who own treasuries are going to lose more than the people who own the S&P. So that's how risky it is. And they're taking all this risk for nothing. What's the yield? What are they getting for all this risk?
You think ultimately we're just heading towards Japan's situation here? I mean, it's inevitable.
Oh, no. We're heading for something way, way worse than Japan. I mean, Japan's in much better shape than we are. You know, we're gonna see a complete implosion of our way of living, because I think that this is it. This is, you know, the financial crisis of 2008 was the beginning of the end. Now we're coming to the middle of the end, not quite the end of the end. But at the end of the end, the U.S. dollar is no longer the reserve currency. And America is just another country.
Right.
And that's going to be a huge, you know, change, because now we're going to have to produce if we want to consume. Now we're going to have to save if we want to borrow. But
yeah.
We don't have an economy that's built for that.
It's so cash up front, right? No more
that,
credit.
Everything is going to – look, people are going to get wiped out. Companies are going to fail. Right. People, I mean, the whole economy is going to have to restructure. The piper is going to have to be paid
right.
for all the days of can kicking by making the problem worse and pushing it down the road with rate cuts and QE. All of a sudden, we're finally going to have to deal with the problem that the Fed created. And the problem is, we're going to have to deal with it in an environment where socialism is extremely popular.
Right.
And maybe Bernie Sanders didn't have enough to do it in 2020. But what about AOC in 2024? So, you know, it is, you know, the government with socialist policies and the Fed with socialist policies has so screwed up the economy and is going to bankrupt so many people and wipe out so many people that it's going to create fertile ground for socialism to be held as the solution to the problems that
right.
it created.
Right.
As opposed to free market-based solutions. Because you don't have people who advocate for the free market, like me, who are in the mainstream. There's nobody out there, you know, even the people out there that, you know, are Republicans and say they're, you know, free market type people, they're out there cheerleading for Donald Trump. They're out there talking about how great the economy is. Well, they're going to look like complete fools when it comes crashing down all around them. Oh, they're discrediting free market capitalism by pretending that that's what we have.
Yeah, just to go back to what you're saying about, you know, letting the free market work, I saw you put up a Twitter post today defending price gouging in these types of situations. Do you want to explain
that? Oh, yeah, I was watching a segment on CNBC about, people are raising prices for certain supplies. I go, well, of course, because, demand's going up. Of course you're going to raise prices.
Right.
So what are you supposed to do? If you don't raise prices, then all your stuff's going to get bought by a few people who are then going to hoard it or resell it on the black market or something.
Right.
You have to prices is a rationing mechanism, right? It's like prices have to go up. Like, let's say water's in short supply, right? Well, the price of water going up will cut down on the use of water. So, water's really expensive, so I'm not going to take as many showers. I'm not going to water my lawn. I'm just going to save it for drinking because it's really scarce, right? So by the price going up, demand, people will cut back on the use. But if the government says, oh, you can't raise the price of water, oh, you're going to control the price, well, we're going to run out of it with people watering their lawns because they're not going to cut back. You need prices to go up to scale back the use. Something is in shortage. But governments always want to come in and they want to say, oh, you can't do this. Okay, fine. Then the products disappear from the shelves and you can't get anything. Or maybe instead of paying a higher price for something, you wait in line for 10 hours. And if you don't have 10 hours to wait in line, then you end up paying somebody to wait in line for you.
Right.
And then, but that would have been cheaper than just, it would have been cheaper to just buy pay the higher price.
Right.
Or like you'll have stuff like, I know in Puerto Rico, the power can go out, right? And when the power goes out, the gas stations can't pump gas. And what happens is, let's say you're a gas station and you invested a generator so that your pumps work when other people's pumps don't. Well, what you would do is when there's a big power outage or there's a hurricane or something, then, you'd be one of the only gas stations with gas. And then so you could raise your prices and you could get a lot of money for the gas. But then you can't do that because of price gouging. So if people know that they can't charge more for their gas when, there's a disaster, they say, well, screw it. I'm not going to invest money in generators. I'm not going to have extra storage because if I can't get any extra money, then what's the point of making this investment? So as a result, nobody does it. And so they make sure you run out of gas. I mean, whenever the government interferes in the free market, it just creates a problem. The free market is what solves problems. Because the prices send powerful signals. When the price goes up, the signal is use less of it, right? Because now it's more expensive. And when the price goes up, the signal that it sends to producers is we need more of this. Go make it. Make more of this stuff, whatever it is. We need more of it. But when the government comes in and prevents something that's scarce from going up in price, people don't economize on it. They keep using it, and we don't get more of it because you don't let the price go up. So it just makes the imbalance bigger. So you always want the free market to function. But the problem is, politicians like to get votes by vilifying a businessman that's raising prices and so-called taking advantage of people, right? Because that's how these guys get elected. And that's why, we vote for socialists, because this nonsense is appealing because people, didn't learn anything in government schools.
Gasoline during
why you don't want governments running schools.
Gasoline during a hurricane is a human right, But yeah, it takes the incentive away to invest capital, because you're not going to get any return on your invested capital in your gas station example, right? So why would
yeah? Let the market work, otherwise, look, people are going to pay higher prices. Like I said, one way or another, because if you control the price and create a shortage, then if you want it, you're going to have to buy it illegally and pay a higher price on the black market. That's what happens. It's not like, it's not like they actually succeed. Or instead of paying a higher price, you just wait in line. And then what's your time worth? What's the cost of that?
Let me ask you one question. I'm going to go back to your discussion about currencies just a couple of moments ago because this just popped in my head. And you got to give me an answer here, right? Wait, if you had to own one fiat currency around the world, what would it be globally? What do you think the strongest out of all the fiats is and why?
Which, yeah, I don't know. You know, I mean, the Swiss franc is obviously like a go-to currency. I mean, a lot of people are going to the yen, but I still got to think there's going to be some problems there at some point. Maybe the Singapore dollar is a little better. I think the Nordic currencies, people think they're socialist, but, Sweden and Norway, I mean, I think their currencies, New Zealand, Australia, when there's inflation and commodity prices are going up, I mean, you know, these currencies are going to hold more of their value. But again, you know,
why
I think
that,
all these
Peter?
Currencies
why
are going to
they...
be are going to be backed by gold. But, you know, the currencies, the U.S. dollar is the most vulnerable because we are the biggest beneficiary of the current monetary system. And we are the issuer of the reserve currency. We get to write the checks that nobody ever cashes. So we get to live beyond our means. And so our economy is going to be most affected by a return to real money, and we're going to return to real money. There's no way that we can continue on this fiat system because that is why, you know, we have these problems. That's why we have these massive bubbles and all of these imbalances, because we took the money out of capitalism and we replaced it with fiat, with just pieces of paper that governments can create at will.
What is
it? And then they use that power to, you know, to inflate these bubbles and we have to deal with the consequences.
What is it specifically about the Nordic currencies and, you know, the Swiss franc that you think gives them strength aside, you know, not being backed by...
Well, you know, I think their economies are just more stable. I mean, Norway obviously has a lot of oil and they have a lot of reserves. I mean, look at their strategic, you know, their reserve, their sovereign wealth fund and things like that. But their budgets, they're in better shape. I mean, yeah, I mean, they have bigger governments, but at least they pay for them. At least they really tax the hell out of the middle class
yeah.
to pay for these programs. But, you know, I mean, they treat capital better. I mean, Sweden doesn't have an inheritance tax. I mean, Bernie Sanders, you know, if he wants to be like Sweden, he'd have to get rid of our inheritance tax because they don't have one over there.
Yeah, he doesn't want to be that much like Sweden, I don't think.
Yeah, but, you know, look, none of these places are bastions of free market capitalism. They just have – they're just not as bad as the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is a gigantic bubble, and this is because of years and years and years of living beyond our means, and, you know, that's been enabled by the dollar as the reserve currency, and we've been able to borrow at such low rates of interest. Look, how can the U.S. government that has almost $24 trillion in debt borrow for 10 years at less than 1%?
Right.
I mean, how is this possible that we have the biggest debts ever, yet we're borrowing at the lowest rate of interest ever? And in addition to that, we have massive unfunded liabilities that are clearly going to be monetized. I'm talking about Social Security, Medicare, Obamacare. I mean, all of this. I mean, so the amount of inflation that bondholders are looking at in the next 10 years, not to mention 30 years, is unprecedented. Yet we have these ridiculously low rates. Imagine what the U.S. economy would be like today if we had to pay interest rates commensurate with the level of debt that we have.
Right.
You know, what if interest rates on treasuries were at record highs, like the size of the debt?
Right.
What if corporations were paying? What if homeowners had to pay record high mortgage interest rates? I mean, look, I mean, where would this economy be?
Well, we've
crippled
the country.
Rates are going to go up there again. I mean, but the Fed is doing everything it can to try to artificially prevent that from happening. It's just like a price control, like we mentioned in the example of, you know, in scarce goods in a hurricane or whatever. Interest rates should be much higher because we have a glut of borrowing and a shortage of savings. We have too much demand and not enough supply of credit. Interest rates should be going up to discourage consumption and borrowing and encourage more savings. But the Federal Reserve is interfering, and by artificially suppressing interest rates, we're not building up the savings that we need, and we keep on borrowing and borrowing more money. And so the bubble's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and every time the free market tries to correct it and bring down the debt and bring up savings, the Fed interferes with the process. And so instead of addressing the imbalances, they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then it's just going to blow. And because it's so big, they're so afraid of letting it blow up that they just can never stop with the stimulus again until we're about to overdose on it and destroy the dollar.
Where do rates go then, Peter?
Well, eventually they're going to go way up. I mean, or because why would you loan money to – let's say the inflation rate goes to 10%, and
right.
It's going to go a lot higher than that. But so if inflation is 10%, are you going to loan somebody money for a year, you know, for 10 years at 1% or 2%?
No.
Or, like, no, of course not.
Right.
So the only willing lender is going to be the Fed, because the Fed doesn't give a damn, because it just creates the money. But then all of a sudden the money starts losing value so quickly, and the problem is the Fed has to then become the only buyer. Because let's say the Fed is just monetizing treasuries. Well, then muni bond rates are going to go up. Well, now they're going to default. So now they have to do that. But now then corporate rates are going to go up. Well, the corporation is going to default. So the Fed becomes the only buyer of everybody's debt. But it can do that only by creating money out of thin air. And then it destroys the dollar. And then it doesn't even matter if you can borrow money, because you're borrowing money that has no value. You're borrowing money that nobody will accept in payment for goods and services. I mean, because once you destroy the currency, nobody wants it. And if nobody wants the dollar, what difference does it make how many of them that you can borrow?
Right.
Because if you can't buy anything with it, then so the whole thing falls apart. But at some point, if the Fed wants to prevent the dollar from becoming monopoly money, they have to end the game. They have to turn off the music and let interest rates soar to whatever their natural price would be. Just like, you know, whenever you have price controls on, eventually you take the controls off and prices go way up to where the market would have wanted them. When you get tired of the shortages and the long lines, right, you realize you made a mistake. And so when the Fed finally says, okay, we're not going to be Weimar Republic Germany, we're not going to be Zimbabwe, we have to have the dollar as a currency, then they have to let interest rates go up, and they have to let the chips fall. They have to let all the defaults happen. They have to let all the bankruptcies happen. Of course, there's going to be a lot more of them now than there would have been had they let it happen a decade ago or two decades ago. And they have to let the government default on its obligations. It's got to tell people, we can't pay Social Security benefits, we can't pay Medicare benefits. It's got to tell the bondholders, I'm sorry, you know, we can't pay the money that we borrowed. We just don't have it anymore. You know, because we have to default. It's a day of reckoning. And that's the only way to avoid hyperinflation, is to do that. And so, you know, in order to avoid something horrific, then we have to do something that's just horrible.
You think that when it comes down to that fork in the road, that's the decision the Fed will make ultimately, that they will let rates soar?
Hopefully, and they don't bail anybody out. They can't bail anybody out, because when they're letting rates go up, that means nobody gets bailed out. And that includes, you know, the banks. I mean, so let's say you have your money to bank and the bank fails. See, everybody thinks, well, my deposits are insured, but only not if the Fed is raising rates and not supplying the liquidity. Where are the banks going to get the money? They're not. Just the FDIC doesn't have anything in its fund. You get a major bank, you get Bank of America, go out of business. You think there's any money there to pay the depositors? So the only way that we can avoid destroying the currency is to allow people who have the currency to lose it. So it's not just that people that own stock in banks are going to lose. And it's not just that people who have bought bonds, right, and own, you know, debt. It's the depositors, because the depositors are really creditors of the bank. When you put your money in the bank, you're making a loan to the bank.
Right.
Now, they're not really giving you any interest, so you're making them an interest-free loan. And why are people doing that? Well, because they assume the government guarantees it, but the government doesn't have anything. So, you know, imagine what the financial crisis would have been like if there were no bailouts, if there was no TARP, if there was no stimulus, right? I mean, what would have happened, right? It would have been much, much worse. Well, this one is going to be far worse than that.
So when the average person, the average investor, the average person listening to my podcast, I mean, and they hear something like that and they say, okay, I understand that. I understand that that's a likely scenario. I want to make sure I'm outside of that box when that happens and the shit hits the fan. How do you do that?
Yeah, that's what I've been doing. Now, I've been telling people about this for a long time, right? So I've been prepared for this disaster for many, many years. And so a lot of people will make fun of me for that, because they think that I'm wrong because I'm preparing for disaster that hasn't happened yet. And the only reason it hasn't happened yet is because the government has succeeded in postponing the day of reckoning. But because they've succeeded, the economy is ultimately going to fail even worse, which means that my preparation will end up being that much more important and that much more profitable. Now, is it possible that they can find a way to kick the can down the road again? Yeah. I mean, I don't know how many more years. I mean, when they go to zero and when they start printing a bunch of money, are they going to make the bubble bigger? Will they be able to send the stock market to new highs? You know, I don't want to take that chance. you know, that they, you know, I don't want to say, I don't want to just hope that they could do it. I'd rather position myself for the fact that eventually they can't do it, because I know that they can't. It can't go on forever. And I think it's, at this point, it's so big that I think they're done. I think their bubble blowing days are over, and the next attempt is going to fail. This is going to be the overdose that I've been preparing for over a decade. And
how have you been preparing? How have you been preparing? What have you been doing to prepare?
I own gold. You know, I own gold stocks. I'm out of the dollar. I own foreign stocks, and I don't own, you know, big high flying stocks with high multiples. I own good businesses, solid balance sheets that pay good dividends, that are in countries that I think, you know, fiscally and, you know, regulatory wise are in better places than the U.S. I think that this crisis is going to hit U.S. businesses particularly hard. I'm very worried about the politics of it, of the confiscation of wealth that might happen in the United States through confiscatory taxation and regulation. You know, there's a lot of writing on the wall that other people are completely ignoring. I mean, maybe they don't see it, or they can't read it, or whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, to the extent that you have people that are listening to your podcast, they should become clients of mine. I mean, they could do it on their own, or they can have me do it for them. In fact, my mutual funds are available at Schwab and Fidelity and, you know, places like that. And some people can be in my gold fund or my value fund or my dividend payers fund or my emerging market fund or my foreign bond fund. And, you know, they can get out of the dollar, or they can work directly with me and I can help you do that. You know, because I think the risks are tremendous. I mean, people are overlooking in the mainstream financial world, overlooking the risk to purchasing power and inflation. They just assume the dollar is always going to be sound.
Right.
And I think that's a foolish assumption to make based on, you know, what's been happening and the debt bubble that we've inflated and where we're going. So, you know, but Wall Street, no one wants to step out on a limb. You know, certain, you know, nobody wants to challenge the conventional wisdom, because there's really nothing in it for them, especially when you're dealing with other people's money. Because if you're wrong, you're going to get punished.
Right.
You know, I mean, if most people on Wall Street, you know, if they lose all their clients' money and all the other brokers have lost all their clients' money, they feel that they did okay. I mean, especially, like, let's say the average guy loses 80% of his money and you only lose him 75% of his money. You're going to think you're a hero. Hey, I beat the market. You only lost 75% instead of 80%. But that's not much consolation to the guy that lost 75%. He's not going to feel like a winner because he didn't lose 80%. You know, on the other hand, you know, I want to make a bunch of money when people lose 80%. And right now, you know, you got a lot of people out there that think they've made money. They haven't made anything. You're playing poker with somebody who you know is a bad player, and he's got a bunch of chips because he got lucky on a few hands, and he thinks he's got a lot of money. But you know, if you're a better player, that he only has that money for a while.
Right.
And eventually you're going to have the money, and that guy's going to go home with nothing, and you're going to have all of his chips. And that's how I feel in the market. I mean, I know there are a lot of people that over the last 10 years have made more money than I did. I mean, I made more money than they did for the first 10 years of this decade. People overlook the amount of money that we made in, you know, from 2000 to 2010. I mean, it was crazy money in gold and silver and foreign stocks and what we made shorting subprime. I mean, I made a lot of money in that decade, right? And in the next decade, no. I mean, obviously, I would have done much better off had I just loaded up on internet
crap, you know,
tech stocks,
right,
or NASDAQ, social media, whatever. But I didn't do that, right? But, you know, the reason I made a lot of money from 2000 to 2010, that decade, is because in the 1990s, when everybody else was buying the dot-coms, that's when I was buying the oil companies and the gold stocks and, you know, doing all this stuff that just paid off such in a big way in the next decade, and because I bet against the housing market with subprime. So I was able to make money there. And then I had 10 years where, you know, I've just been positioning for the next big score, which is about to happen. And I think all the people that, you know, think that they've made their money back. Remember, these are the people that got wiped out in the dot-com crash that they didn't see coming. And then they got saved by the Fed. And then they got wiped out again when the housing bubble burst. They didn't see that one coming.
Right.
They got saved again by the Fed.
Right.
So you got foolish people who got bailed out of their foolishness twice before. They're about to have it again. They're about to lose a bunch of money again. They don't see this crisis coming, even though it's more obvious than the last ones. But I think when their buddies at the Fed try to bail them out, it's not going to work.
Well, and you talk about
either people are going to lose most of their money, or most, or their money is going to lose most of its value. But either way, it's going to be a bad ending to this. But I'm in a great position, I think, and anybody who's, you know, been investing along, you know, alongside me or been following this theme, I think we stand to make a lot of money. Now, the only problem is how much of it will we keep? I mean, I'm in Puerto Rico, so I have zero capital gains tax. But who knows, you know, how high capital gains taxes are going to go. So a lot of the gains may end up being taxed away, you know.
Yeah, when you talk about the writing being on the wall earlier, and now you're talking about things like that, like capital gains taxes going up. You know, one of the things that Steve Mnuchin came out like 2 days ago and said, hey, just so everybody knows, we're not thinking about closing down the markets. And it's like, all right, well, why would you say that? You know, I mean, do you think that's a possibility? Do you think it goes that far where the markets just
start? I don't think anybody thought it was a possibility until they denied that it was happening.
Well, that's my
point. You know, never believe a rumor until it's denied.
Right. Exactly. I mean, what do you do in a situation like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, plus, I'm not worried about them shutting down the market because I know all my stuff's going to go up. I wasn't playing, but I mean, I can see that being scary for a lot of people who now they can't sell.
Right.
And, you know, they're not getting any dividends really. So what, you know, what good is are your stocks if you can't sell them and they're not paying any dividends?
Yeah. I noticed that just over the last couple of days too, your television appearances have started to tick up a little bit more. Have you been getting a little bit more action, getting some more phone calls?
I got a little bit. You know, I was on Fox News the other day, and I wish Tucker Carlson would run the piece they taped on the Fed. That was a couple of weeks ago. But, of course, you know, CNBC would never call me. I mean, I know they think about me every time the price of gold goes up, but no way they would ever call me to talk about it.
You think it's over with CNBC?
Huh?
You think it's over with them? I mean, you were on there like 6 months ago.
Oh, yeah. What? Oh, yeah. Plus, I make fun of them all the time now, so I'm sure I burned the bridge, if there even was a bridge.
Yeah, but I mean, if they understood how important it is to have perspective, they wouldn't let that hinder whether or not they...
No, look, in 5 or 10 years, they're not even going to be in business anymore. I mean, my podcast probably already has more listeners than they do. But yeah, I mean, they're going to be gone. I mean, their audience would have been wiped out. I mean, they've never met a bubble that they didn't cheerlead. I mean, these guys even fell for Bitcoin. Of course, they didn't tell their audience to buy it, you know, when it was, you know, $10 to $100. They waited until it got to like 10 to 20,000 before trying to, you know, push everybody into it.
Yeah, and not only like push everybody into it, but Brian Kelly spun up a crypto fund out of nowhere that he was pitching.
Oh, yeah,
there.
They pumped and dumped everything. They got people into all kinds of altcoins right at the peak. I mean, crazy stuff.
Yeah, and it's just, you know? It's funny that something like that will happen. Like, he will go on Fast Money and talk about his BK crypto asset management with Bitcoin at 17,000 or 20,000, whatever. But all of a sudden, when you go on and you say, oh, buy gold, all of a sudden it's, Peter, you're trying to sell something, you know?
Yeah, they never accuse these crypto guys of, you know, having a bias when they clearly do. And the thing is, it doesn't even matter what I say on CNBC about gold. Nothing I say is going to influence the price. So I can't, like, talk gold up.
Right,
it's too big a market.
Right.
But you go on there and talk about some little crypto coin that, you know, I mean, you can move the price dramatically just with one CNBC appearance.
Yeah, it was funny they had...
And especially if you're running a fund that's completely dependent on this currency going up.
Oh, hell yeah. And it's funny, they had Novogratz on like 3 days ago or 4 days ago, and set right after the week when we got tatered, right after the week when the Dow went down like 4,000 points, whatever it was that one week. And so they roll out Novogratz. Of course, they're rolling out like the same 50, 75 people, Peter, none of whom predicted what had happened, right? So let's go back to them because they're the authorities. And Sarah Eisen says to Novogratz, you were on the program 2 weeks ago with the stock market at all-time highs, and you said you were extraordinarily bullish because you were looking for big bazookas. You know, do you still feel the same way? It's like, why are you even asking him? Like,
yeah, meanwhile, I actually think it would be ironic, but the coronavirus could be the pin that pricks both the stock market bubble and the Bitcoin bubble. Because if Bitcoin can't rally on this coronavirus, which so far it has not, right? It's around 9,000, you know, and if it can't rally on this, right? And gold is taking off and markets are imploding. All this stuff is happening. If it can't rally on this, then when's it going to rally?
You think this is the test for Bitcoin?
And then everybody's going to sell because people only own it because they're convinced it's going to go up. Well, if it won't go up, when you have all this good news, and this is an old stock market thing that most of these crypto guys are clueless about because they're young kids and they don't know anything about the market. But, you know, if something won't go up on good news, that's a bad sign, right? Now, there's no way you can tell me that all this turmoil is not good news for Bitcoin.
Right.
I mean, this is supposedly what Bitcoin is here for.
Right.
Yet it's not going anywhere. So it means that somebody is selling. There is, right, people are – obviously there are people buying Bitcoin now because of all this. But the price isn't going up. Somebody is selling. Who? And how much more do they have to sell, right? So that if all of a sudden, you know, we get an implosion here of crypto, then, you know, that bubble could pop too.
So you think this is Bitcoin's, like, real first test, right? Because this is really the first kind of market-wide existential turmoil that we've had since Bitcoin has become a thing, right?
Yeah, basically, because it really started after the last financial crisis, and we haven't had another one since then, so...
So this will be the situation where people that argue that it's a safe haven, right, would expect to see money plow into Bitcoin instead of out of it in this situation.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. I got one more question for you, Peter.
Well, it's supposed to be digital gold, and gold keeps going up, and Bitcoin doesn't.
Well, digital gold is an oxymoron, right? Gold you can take
out. I say it's like a digital house. Yeah, I got a digital house. Oh, okay. Can you live in it? What can you do with your digital house? Can't do anything more with a digital house than with digital gold.
Yeah. Well, one more question. Where do you see gold at the end of the year this year? Where do you see it in 5 years? Let me in on what you
think.
Well,
I see it higher at the end of the year and much higher than that at the end of 5 years.
But I knew you were
going to
say that.
I don't know exactly how high it's going to go, but you don't have to know how high it's going to go. You just have to buy it if you know it's going higher. And since I think it's going higher, I think gold stocks are going much higher because they're priced for gold going lower, right? Because this, as I said earlier in this podcast, the investors and the speculators are betting that the gold price is going to be lower in the future than it is in the present. Because if they thought it was going to be the same, they would be buying these gold stocks because they're going to make a lot of money if the price of gold stays where it is. So they think the price of gold is going to fall. So gold stocks are priced for a lower gold price, and not a higher gold price. So when gold does go higher and surprises everybody, not only do you get the gain on the upside, but you get the extra gain because now they have to price out the price fall that they had already priced in. So there's so much, you know, pent up upside in these gold stocks. And again, I think the best way is my gold fund. And the reason I think so is, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's hard to really add value as a portfolio manager. You have the idea of an efficient market, right? That, hey, let's just buy an index because markets are efficient and therefore there's not going to be any real value because you have all these analysts studying all these stocks. And so why pay somebody a management fee? I'll just, you know, buy an index. And, you know, you can make that argument, but you can't really make it in gold stocks because I could tell you that gold stocks are so unloved and had been in a bear market for so long that there really are no good analysts in the sector. I mean, most smart guys are in other sectors that people care about. They're not they're not in the mining space, right? They're in biotech or they're in telecommunications or whatever they're doing, right? They're in sexier, hotter sectors. That's where all the smart guys are. And so to find somebody that actually knows the mining industry, right, that can tell, you know, a gold mine from a hole in the wall, right, a hole in the ground. So I got Adrian Day, who's managing my gold fund, who's managed gold stocks for 30 or 40 years, right, throughout the bull and bear markets. He's been in this his whole life, and he really knows the sector. He knows the companies. He knows the management teams. He knows which ones are good and which ones are bad and which stories are BS and which are real. And so I think he adds a tremendous amount of value rather than just buying an index or just buying all the stocks. To have one guy who actually knows this industry, we have a competitive advantage over people who don't. And so I think we're going to way outperform the benchmarks and way outperform an index. And I think it more than justifies the management fee that we charge to have access to Adrian's expertise. to be able to, you know, buy the home runs and avoid, you know, the strikeouts, which I think is going to do, especially in the junior sector. I mean, if you're just buying the big stocks, anybody could do that. But the real money is going to be made in these smaller companies. But that's where the real money is also going to be lost. So you got to hire somebody who knows what he's doing. That's why I didn't even do it myself. I could have managed it myself. I went out and I hired Adrian to do it for me. So it's the Euro Pacific Gold Fund, and we have five stars, Morningstar. So I mean, over the 5 years we've been doing it, almost six now. But we've been doing a good job. But that's been in a bear market. So wait till you see how we do in a bull market. We're doing better, I think.
When gold goes to all time highs, and I fly down to Puerto Rico, are we going to go out and drink Manhattans again, or what?
Well, you don't have to wait for gold to hit an all time high. If you're in Puerto Rico, look me up.
All right, I'll be on a plane tonight.
But you know, you don't have to wait long. I mean, gold's not that far. And as I said earlier in the podcast, we're hitting new record highs every day in every other currency.
Yeah.
So it's just the dollar's just the last one, but we're going to get there.
Well, and I did want to tell you one other thing. Your son is a genius. I've been just reading his tweets. And, man, I mean, I guess living with you, he gets it every day. I mean, every day he's getting an education. But
do you follow him? You're following him on Twitter?
Yeah, I've followed him for a while since I met him in New York. So I follow his tweets.
Yeah, I mean, he's got almost 4,000 followers. He's got some good stuff. So if you're listening, you're Spencer Schiff. I forget his Twitter handle, but... and he listens to your podcast too. He listens to a lot of Austrian type economic podcasts. He's very into the markets and economics. So,
yeah, he's a smart kid. So, good job, yeah. Good job raising him, Mr. Schiff. Thank you so much, brother. I appreciate you coming on and giving an hour to my listeners. And
all right, and now you know what? Now that I finish your podcast, I got to start my own. So,
okay,
if you don't listen to mine, Peter Schiff Show podcast.
You want to have me on as a guest?
The one I do.
You want me to call you back?
I got
to
take a little break, though, and rest my voice. I've been talking for an hour.
Yeah. Well, have a little whiskey. You'll be all right. All right, Peter. Thank you so much, brother. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right. That was the one, the only Peter Schiff. The man, Peter Schiff. Schiff, not shift. I don't know what I'm doing, folks. I'm not very professional here. Laying it down. That's what he thinks is going to happen. He said gold's going to all-time highs. Looks like he's going to be right. Everybody that made fun of him for the last decade... Nope, you guys are going to be wrong. I like it. I like it. It's been an obvious long gold, if you ask me. And, of course, obviously, if you ask Mr. Schiff. So I think he's been on the ball here for quite some time. And time will tell if he's proven right or wrong, whether or not the Fed can inflate this bubble one more time. But even if they do, it should be bullish for gold, and I own it. But again, not investment advice, not a financial advisor, and I got shit to do too. So I'm out of here. Peace.